It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll talk to a food writer about vegetarian entrees.
First, two American aid workers who contracted Ebola in West Africa are being airlifted to the United States for treatment. Soon after that news broke, social media sites exploded with people expressing fears that it could spread here in the U.S.
The Ebola outbreak in West Africa is the deadliest on record. According to the World Health Organization, more than 1,300 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone have contracted the disease since March. More than half of them have died. So, should we be worried about an Ebola outbreak here in the U.S.?
With us now is Donald Francis, epidemiologist with Global Solutions for Infectious Diseases, a nonprofit global health organization. He was part of a World Health Organization team sent to inspect the first ever Ebola outbreak in 1976. Dr. Francis, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, can you tell us about your first encounter with the Ebola virus in 1976? What struck you the most about this disease?
Well, that, you know, for someone who's, I kind of started my career getting into dangerous bugs accidentally, and this one got your attention very, very quickly in terms of the extreme mortality of it. We didn't know at that time exactly the transmission. We had to figure out all the transmission, interview all the survivors and the family members to figure out how it was transmitted. Which, for anyone working there, you want to know how it's transmitted so you can protect yourself. So in the meantime, you're in these, you know, monkey suits with your respirators and in the heat of tropical Africa trying to figure out, by interviewing patients and survivors, exactly how they got their disease. And it very rapidly, you see, that it was very, very close contact. It was not airborne or aerosol, but it was... the downside is when you did get it, the disease was really very, very severe. With, you know, depending on what outbreak you've then and subsequently, somewhere between 50% and 80% mortality.
And what makes it so severe?
The bug probably because it's not been selected out for humans. It's not a human bug, and those kind of things get adjusted as the eons go by. Because it's when it essentially kills all the hosts, and that's not a very good parasite. Your parasite wants to keep the host alive for a while so it can replicate and go elsewhere. But this one probably does that in bats, and they're very well adjusted. But when they get to any larger animal, it just kills them all.
Well, now we've got this Ebola outbreak in West Africa, the largest ever. Why did this one spread so quickly as compared to ones we've seen in the past?
Well, that we really have to determine, but I suspect is that this is an area where it had not had Ebola before, and always in the first, much like since I was on the first outbreak, it just kind of cruises on. You don't really recognize it as being as dangerous as it is until it gets way out of control, gets into hospitals and spreads in hospitals or close contact quarters with people, and so it's. Not recognized, and so people don't run for the bush, and you get more and more cases, and then you have funerals, and people wash the body, and then they get infected from the virus outside the body, and so it goes on and on and on. And then the next years you get it far fewer because humans get educated about it.
Well, today the news broke that there are two American aid workers who have Ebola. They apparently were sick in West Africa, took a turn for the worse, and the powers that be decided to airlift them back to the United States for treatment. And with that news, social media erupted. People's fears about this virus also erupted along with it. How concerned should we here in the United States be about an Ebola outbreak?
Well, usually these things take care of themselves very quickly because they're... I mean, if you compare this with HIV, it's totally different. Here you have HIV, which is indeed has a higher mortality than Ebola, but it's got a long, long incubation period where it's silent. Ebola's got a short incubation, so you see the cases very quickly, and so it essentially the fire burns out very quickly. And so you know where it is, you can see where it is. It's not this underground, hidden outbreak of other kind of diseases like HIV.
Well, how does Ebola spread?
It has high replication in the body, and especially in any parts of the organs of the body where it's replicating primarily in the liver, and so it gets very, very high concentrations in the blood and oozes out through your normal orifices, but also any time it goes very long, then you start having this blood oozing from everywhere. And there's really thousands and thousands of viral particles per drop of blood. And so it just gets lots of virus, gets out, and then people get it on their hands or get it in a cut and probably put it in their eyes or scratch themselves. The skin is probably pretty good at protecting. But any opening in the skin, any scratch, or getting into your oral or other mucous membranes, it'll start replicating.
Right. From what I've read, we should be less concerned about this because it does spread from, as you say, bodily fluids. It's not something where it's as an aerosol transmission, so that makes it less worrisome to people. Do you agree with that? Are fears unfounded that we need to be worried about, you know, it running rampant?
No, it's the danger is when you get into, you know, situations where it we're using sharp instruments and such in hospitals, and that in the laboratory in the hospital, people with needles and syringes, on any mistake like that. Indeed, in the work that I've been involved in, some of the very, very good laboratory workers slipped and poked their glove with a needle, and that'll do it. You can get very, very sick. So for the average person, this is not something that is going to spread wildly.
Now, as we've said, Ebola has a very high mortality rate, but not everyone dies from this virus. Do we know why the people who are surviving are surviving?
No, at least I don't. We tried to figure some of that out, but some people have, I think any infectious disease, that some people just replicate so much better, and you get more and more virus there. And that's true of all diseases, actually. Ebola is shocking because so many people do die, whereas most of the diseases we deal with, a rare person dies, and some people don't even get any symptoms whatsoever. So it's a matter of how much virus is multiplying.
Is there a risk in bringing these two patients from Africa back to the United States, or is this something that people should just, you know, be quiet about and, I guess, compassionate about?
Well, this is the risk is trivial. This is about as high class isolation as you'll ever find. CDC has set up this exact system to do this, and indeed, it started when we all started going off in these epidemics of what are we going to do with any of the people you send off to investigate the outbreak and who's going to take care of them. And so, you had to get a system to be able to take care of them, and so these units are set up to do exactly that. And it's not the community that has to worry. It's the healthcare workers, and they're all trained to do this, but they have to be very, very careful taking care of these people.
But then I've seen headlines that seem to, you know, designed to induce fear, quotes like, Ebola is just a plane flight away. Is that scaremongering?
Well, I think if you look around the world, there's many, many viruses that are a plane flight away, and not to mention you've got HIV, you know, a hop, skip, and a jump from your doorstep. So we've got bugs around the world like that. We just have to use our brains and avoid them.
Unless I want to ask you about a possible vaccine, there is news that trials could begin in September. What do we know about a vaccine for Ebola?
I mean, they've been playing with doing experiments with Ebola vaccine for years, and I'm not. No, they're talking about actually doing some human trials, but I'm not as familiar of how far along it is. And I've worked on vaccines for years and years, and they take time. And they're not. And how do you do a trial for an Ebola vaccine except in a monkey that you can challenge? Because you're not going to get any human volunteers to take the vaccine and then be challenged with the virus to see if they're protected. And you don't have enough people to do a large trial in West Africa because there's not enough disease to test it. So it's a challenge.
So this is not, as you see it, a quick silver bullet?
No.
Any advice you would give people who are traveling? Is there anything people need to do differently or just maybe calm down?
No, not really. I mean, I think these are very isolated situations where they get in hospitals or into funerals or into families, and the odds of people getting involved in that, unless you're a healthcare worker, who is exactly what we're talking about, people flying in are healthcare workers, and they get exposed in the hospitals. And if they're there, the interesting thing from an ethical standpoint is that those people are there, and when you're a doctor, you have to take care of them, as I had to do with the Ebola patients in Sudan. And you that's your job. And sometimes you have high risk of infection, and that's what we have here.
Well, thank you so much for joining
us. Not the general population.
Great.
Sure, my pleasure.
That was Donald Francis, epidemiologist with Global Solutions for Infectious Diseases. He was part of a World Health Organization team sent to inspect the first ever Ebola outbreak in 1976. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Time now for Food Friday. Today, vegetarians are everywhere, and food writers like Michael Pollan are encouraging even the meat eaters to cut back a little and explore more plant-based foods. Wasn't always this way. When the modern vegetarian diet started in the 1960s, it was way more limited. Today, though, most home chefs like to have at least one vegetarian recipe in their back pocket.
Food writer Joanne Dembski is with us to talk about this transformation and attitude towards vegetarians and about the staples of the vegetarian diet. She's a freelance writer and a former staff member for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and for the most part, she's a vegetarian. Joanne, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on your show.
Joanne, you've been a pescatarian. I guess that's someone who eats some fish, but it's the rest of your diet is vegetarian for 40 years. Why did you
Correct.
Decide to remove most meat from your diet?
I initially did it to lose some weight, and then after a few months I did lose some weight, but I also felt so much better that I just decided to stay meatless, and I've never turned back.
And we mentioned you eat some fish. There are a lot of different kinds of vegetarianism and shades of vegetarianism out there. What are some of the different ways people approach that?
Well, it's pretty much some people just avoid red meats, and often that's because they want to lower their cholesterol. Then you have people like myself who I just eat the seafood. You also have complete vegetarians, and those would be people who don't eat any of the meat products. And then, of course, you have vegans who don't eat anything that comes from animals.
How would you say that attitudes are different today than when vegetarian first popped up in the 60s?
Oh, I think the attitudes are very different. I think today it's fairly mainstream. Many of my friends and a lot of my family members are now going meatless, and I'm also hearing that a lot of teens are going meatless. They're just deciding to do it for health reasons and maybe because they don't want to hurt animals.
And how have the options for vegetarians changed since, you know, it got big in the 60s?
There's so many more things that are available for people to eat. There's all the different vegetables, there's a lot more vegetables and fruits that weren't available years ago. You've got all the different dairy products and grains, a wide variety of cheeses that weren't available years ago. There's even meat substitute products like veggie burgers, things like that. Some people, if they do miss eating meat, they go towards those products and try them.
What do you think about getting your protein from a meat substitute? Do you think that's, you know, adequately carrying the torch for vegetarianism?
Well, I think you certainly can get your protein from those products. I personally don't think they are often very taste very good. I prefer to use dairy products, beans, grains, things like quinoa, nuts, and seeds.
Before we get into some recipes and entree ideas, it just sounds like eating vegetarian is a lot more fun and flavorful than it was at the outset.
Oh, it is. When I first started eating meat, going meatless years ago, there weren't a lot of options out there. You just kind of had to try to make dishes yourself or take recipes and just remove the meats. Now there's so many different products that are available, and, it's not just the blocks of tofu marinated in, you know, tempeh or something like that. There's just a lot of different products out there. And there's a lot of, if you go to Asian stores, there's so many different options and seasonings that can really make these dishes taste better.
Well, let's dig into some of the recipes that you shared with us. The first one is beans and barley lemon apricot quinoa. So a lot going on there already that sounds exciting. Mm-hmm. And you've got as your base the quinoa, which is a grain with a lot of protein.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that one?
Quinoa is really a great food for vegetarians, and I really feel it's very important. In fact, I just recently read that it was first cultivated over 5,000 years ago, and that the Incas used to call it the mother of all grains. And it's also one of the few plant foods that's considered a complete protein. It's also gluten-free, contains iron, B vitamins, magnesium, phosphorus, potassium, calcium, vitamin E, and fiber. So it's good in so many ways for people. And it tastes great, too. The recipe, the apricot quinoa recipe, it also has so many other delicious things in there. It just really complements the quinoa, the dried apricots, the red bell pepper, the currants, the pine nuts.
Well, speaking of quinoa, Joanne, that's an ingredient that people are finding more and more available in stores. And reading your piece on this, it used to be something like even a red pepper was exotic, and you could only find it in different parts of the country. And people were careful to write their recipe books to not include that kind of ingredient in some cases.
Right. When I did the interviews, that's what I was hearing. You know, I don't honestly remember 40 years ago if I was finding those things or not. I just ate whatever vegetables I could find. But these food writers were saying that they had a terrible time with trying to be creative and to find good recipes. But fortunately, that's all changed now. There's so many different options.
So you've got the quinoa and the apricots in this. How does it come together? And how long does something like this take to cook? Because that's a point that comes up a lot when you're trying to talk about vegetarianism. People say, I could never do it because of all the chopping and the waiting. How long does this take?
Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't actually test that particular recipe, although I certainly wanted to. But I'm guessing just by looking at it, it doesn't take long at all to put it together because, you know, it takes a few minutes to chop up a bell pepper and pine nuts and currants. Those are all ready to roll. So I think it's more or less just combining the ingredients and having them prepped and put them together. And it also had a dressing on it that could easily be made in advance, which would be a time saver.
You also talk about the rise in availability of eggplant and people figuring out more and more what to do with it. How has eggplant jazzed up the veggie options for us?
Well, there's all these different kinds of eggplant available, for one. You've got the Japanese eggplants, the baby eggplants, and those are really have slightly different tastes, and they're very interesting looking. So I think a lot of people are using those just like they're using portobellos as kind of the main ingredient in their recipes to kind of make them special and kind of give you a meat substitute of a sort.
Well, you've got another recipe that you share, this one for penne, some pasta with eggplant and mozzarella. Mm-hmm. What was your experience with this one?
I did make that one, actually. That was very tasty. I liked it because it had the two different cheeses in it. And the combination just really went well together. And I was also able to, my husband is not a vegetarian, so I was able to give him some by just putting some roasted chicken on it, and he said he thought it was great.
So it's got the mozzarella. What's your other cheese in there?
Mozzarella and, let me see, I think it was a Gruyere.
That'd be really good.
Cheese. Yeah.
I'll go with Gruyere.
Cheese. Yeah. It was good. That's one of my favorites, and I've never met a cheese I didn't like, so anything with a lot of cheese on it is always going to be a plus for me.
So a lot of people will continue eating meat, not want to go full vegetarian, but make the case why even the meat eaters should pay attention to vegetarian recipes, throw them into the mix sometime.
Well, it's just such a healthy way to eat, and by eating more plant-based foods, you're going to have more energy, your cholesterol is likely to lower, and you're also going to find out there's a lot of great meatless dishes out there. A lot of people, I think, especially people who are really fixed on eating, especially red meats, they just feel that they're not going to be satisfied if they don't have that hunk of meat on their plate. But in reality, eating things like the eggplant and the portobellos and maybe even the meat substitutes, you can get a great meal out of it and be so much healthier. So you can still have that steak when you want to, maybe just not as often.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Joanne, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
That was Joanne Dembski. She's a freelance writer, former staff member from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Moriarty has tried to kill him many times. Arthur Conan Doyle finished him off once, but Sherlock Holmes keeps coming back again and again.
More recently, the estate of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle lost a copyright case with a judge ruling that Holmes and Dr. Watson are now in the public domain.
Laura Miller joins us now. She's co-founder and staff writer at Salon.com. She recently wrote the piece, A Study in Sherlock, for Harper's Magazine. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to Sherlock in the public domain, let's talk about what makes this character so appealing that he keeps coming back and being reinvented again and again.
Well, it is a little bit of a mystery. I think that every generation sees something that it craves in Holmes. Of course, there's his incredible deductive powers that seem almost like a magical skill, but then can be, you know, the lid can be ripped off and he shows Watson or whoever else happens to be around that it's all perfectly rational. So it's a way of sort of making the advanced technological society that we live in and science and rationality seem less mysterious. But there's also the incredibly close relationship between him and Watson, and there is something very powerful about that bond that in many ways is the core of the stories. And of course, they're just like great campy fun. So it kind of depends on what you're looking for, and I think that's the secret of any really long-lived character or story is that it meets all kinds of needs.
Well, in a way, he seems like such a product of England, but he's had a worldwide appeal. We love him here in the United States, that's for sure. So why does he translate to our time and our place?
Yeah, that is a difficult... you're asking me to put my fingers on kind of a mystery here. But I think that there is a particular charm to the era of England that he lived in, the late Victorian era. Of course, it wasn't like the real late Victorian era. It's like a fantasia of that time period in the same way that, say, The Lord of the Rings offers a sort of fantasia of medieval British rural life. You know, it's a whole world. It's very extensive, though, and it's a kind of an alternate reality that people can enter into. There are these hardcore Sherlockian fan clubs where everyone gets the name of a minor character and people dress up in costumes. And there's something about that kind of world building that certain fan bases really respond to. And I think that's another part of the appeal. You can just immerse yourself in Sherlockiana.
Well, you write about the court case that led to the character and his colleagues being put in the public domain in the U.S. outside of the control of the Arthur Conan Doyle estate. What does that mean for the future of the character?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing because the copyright status of Sherlock Holmes is kind of ambiguous. I mean, he's in the public domain in the U.K. already, or he was before this finding. You know, in the short term, it means that when someone wants to do an anthology of sort of Sherlock Holmes spin-off stories, which is who the other party in this case was an editor who wanted to do that, they don't have to pay a fee to the estate. People can do adaptations, spin-offs, stories about minor characters from the main canon of Sherlock Holmes. All of this stuff, they can do this without worrying that they're violating a copyright. But that's not to say that people haven't already been doing that for years.
Now, this kind of thing hasn't always succeeded in the courts. Not that long ago, there was a Gone with the Wind sequel that was shut down because it didn't pass muster legally. Why did this one get over the gate?
It just aged out. Gone with the Wind was published, I believe, sometime in the 1930s. And depending on the work and depending on the publication date, it's usually around 75 years the original creator or his or her heirs owns the rights. The Margaret Mitchell estate successfully argued that, or no, actually, they didn't successfully argue because Wind Undone, the book you're talking about, was eventually published. It was not withdrawn as a parody or satire, which is a legal use of the source material. But it came to court to begin with because the Margaret Mitchell estate still owned the rights to that. What was being decided was not whether these works were derivative, because they clearly were derivative of the Sherlock Holmes stories. It was whether the Conan Doyle estate still retained the rights to the character.
You quote the editor of the volume of Sherlock Holmes stories in question saying, quote, "Sherlock Holmes belongs to the world now." Does he?
Absolutely. I think that when I wrote that piece, it was partly about the original stories, but it was also about the different ways that Holmes and Watson have been portrayed on the stage, in films, on television, in sort of fan fiction, and in stories that sort of, you know, imagine Holmes' adventures as an old man, or things that happened while he was on his great hiatus, the period when everyone thought that he was dead and he had all of these adventures. You know, there have been these sort of expose type stories, like a very famous and successful book called The 7% Solution, published in the 70s by Nicholas Meyer, which was about Sherlock Holmes's cocaine addiction, and posited that Watson always claimed that he had sort of weaned Holmes of his drug use. And so Meyer imagined that he took him to Vienna and had him treated by Sigmund Freud, who, you know, unearthed the truth about Professor Moriarty not actually being a supervillain. And so these are these kind of, you know, that was an era, the 70s was an era when psychotherapy was just all the rage. And so he was therapized. Today's Sherlock Holmeses tend to be people who are maybe on the autism spectrum. You know, not only can they not be, quote, cured, unquote, but they don't even necessarily want to be. They see their oddness or their unusual personalities as a strength rather than an illness.
I want to look at a couple of the most popular dramatic TV presentations of Sherlock Holmes over the last couple of generations. Let's start in the 80s with Jeremy Brett, a series I watched at the time and I know a lot of people loved. Let's give a listen to Jeremy Brett as Sherlock Holmes.
Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram, the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my proper atmosphere. Then I can dispense with artificial stimulants. But I abhor the dull routine of existence. I crave mental exaltation. That is why I've chosen my own profession, or rather, created it, for I am the only one in the world.
And for a lot of people, he was the only Sherlock Holmes in the world, Jeremy Brett. Laura, what did you make of that rendition of Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, so great. I think he really is the gold standard of Sherlock Holmes. And people who are curious about that, I think you can still find a lot of those episodes on YouTube. The thing about Jeremy Brett was that the actor himself was manic depressive. And part of his characterization of Holmes, which famously consumed him in his autobiography, wrote about how he, you know, had that classic actor's dilemma of becoming completely entangled with the character. You know, part of his characterization, his understanding of Holmes, was in that perfectly chosen clip that you just played, the mental exaltation and then of being on a case and then the dull routine of just ordinary life that Holmes couldn't endure. And so he had to take drugs to medicate it away. I mean, that was the essence of Brett's depiction of Holmes.
It's interesting when you contrast, you know, how beloved Holmes is today as a character in fiction and in film with how little Sir Arthur Conan Doyle seemed to like him. Didn't he sort of say, I don't care what you do with him, kill him off, whatever, I don't care, he's not high art.
Yeah, what Conan Doyle wanted to do was write this kind of very high-flown moral historical fiction, sort of like Sir Walter Scott, I think, would be his role model. And not a whole lot of people read Sir Walter Scott anymore these days, but, you know, when Conan Doyle was growing up, he was really kind of the, you know, novelist that everyone, he was hugely popular and everyone admired him. And so he you know, he kind of cranked out these Holmes stories. They're really inconsistent. I mean, you know, Watson's wound is sometimes in his leg and sometimes in his shoulder, and no one knows what his wife's name is or what if she's died, or, you know, they were inconsistent because the kind of slapdash because they didn't really matter that much to Conan Doyle. He did not think, he was a little bit like, you know, there was this whole thing in the 70s and 80s of how Woody Allen wanted to make these serious sort of Ingmar Bergman style movies, but everyone wanted him to make comedies. And he complained that he was, you know, constantly being forced to make these goofy comedies when he wanted to make these serious art films. And Conan Doyle was in a similar position.
We're talking about the many lives of Sherlock Holmes with Laura Miller of Salon.com, looking at a fictional character who's been reinvented again and again. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about Sherlock Holmes now and the ways he's been reinvented over the years on books, on TV, and in the movies.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? What is your favorite version? Maybe one of the TV renditions, a movie, a favorite story, a tribute to Sherlock Holmes? Or is there one that you think really got it wrong? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to take a listen to another clip. This is of a different rendition of Sherlock Holmes. This is Benedict Cumberbatch's version. Wow, it's hard to say, isn't
it?
This is a version that lots of people are literally and figuratively in love with. Here is Benedict Cumberbatch as Sherlock.
Oh, John, I envy you so much.
You envy me?
Your mind, so placid, straightforward, barely used. Mine's like an engine racing out of control. A rocket tearing itself to pieces, trapped on the launch pad.
I need a case!
You've just solved one by harpooning a dead pig, apparently.
That was this morning.
I have to say, I'm a Sherlock fan. What do you think of that version, Laura?
I really like the new Sherlock. I like the way that it's set in the modern day London. I like the way that contemporary technology is incorporated and new sort of filmmaking techniques are used. I think that the sort of arch tone of it is actually perfectly compatible with the original stories, but a lot of people feel differently.
What do you make of some of the ways they use that technology? Dr. Watson is blogging about Holmes instead of writing stories about him. And texting, we see the texts as they're sent back and forth, and that makes a difference. That doesn't interfere with the story for you?
Well, no. You know, the thing about Sherlock Holmes is that because he belongs to everybody, there are ways that the character can be added to that only increase your enjoyment. I mean, we know that if Sherlock Holmes were alive today, of course he would text all the time because it's intrusive. You get to sort of say, what I have to say to you is so important, you have to pay attention to it right now, at the same time that it's kind of antisocial. You don't actually have to see or speak to the person. He broadcasts messages to large groups of people, but they can't respond to. I mean, there are just all these techniques that the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock uses, you know, whether it's texting or passwords or any of these other technological devices that are part of our lives or technological practices. You know, he uses them in a way that is perfectly consistent with the original character. And because we know that character so well, there's something really delightful about seeing this adaptation.
And you said that some people have a problem with it. What are the criticisms you've heard leveled against the new version of Sherlock?
Oh, I think some people probably think that the tone is a little bit too campy, or they just don't like the actors, Cumberbatch in particular. They feel it's too stylized. They like a more sort of serious and straightforward Holmes. But I just think that the originals were so kind of campy in their own right, and I think deliberately so, that I just can't really subscribe to that.
Talking to Laura Miller of Salon.com about Sherlock Holmes. Go to our callers now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. We've got Deborah on the line in Milwaukee. Deborah, hi.
Hi. My favorite was Jeremy Brett, and I used to see him frequently on PBS, but they don't show it quite as much as they used to, but I bought a VHS like 10 years ago. Or longer, when my son was young, and there was a Sherlock Holmes animated version, and it was animals that were the characters, dogs, and Holmes, in one point of the VHS or the movie, he'd say, "I can't see through all the shrubbery," and when my son would then like remember that, and he would call things shrubbery, and he said, "I got that from that Sherlock Holmes movie you bought." And so I always think of that now whenever I see shrubbery.
Deborah, thank you so much for sharing that. That's a great story. Well, Sherlock Holmes, in addition to being a cartoon dog, he's been played for comedy by John Cleese. He's fought Nazis and I think vampires in fiction. People can do anything with him, can't they, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the qualities of a sort of great pop culture myth, because that's really what he has become. You know, he's become like Brer Rabbit or the Jack character from Fairy Tales. He has all different kinds of adventures. He's always recognizably the same character, even though sometimes these depictions are really, really different, and he can be put into all different kinds of stories. And it's a kind of testimony to how sort of eternal and how constantly changing he is.
Wasn't there some sort of deliberate smudging about whether Sherlock Holmes was fact or fiction for a while?
Well, he was based on a real person, a medical professor who Conan Doyle studied. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a physician. But the original Sherlock Holmes fandom, which was really the first modern fandom, was kind of sprang out of a game that was eventually called The Great Game that Sherlock Holmes fans would play together, where they would try to make up explanations for the inconsistencies in the stories, and they would come up with these elaborate theories, and then they kind of spun off from that so that, certain characters from other writers would be like the secret love child of Sherlock Holmes and Irene Adler or just all kinds of wild stuff that they would write these academic or faux academic papers about. And it was partly just a way of sort of entering further into the world of Sherlock Holmes and also sort of a way of making fun of academic or scholarly writing. So it was a sort of a group that would meet really regularly in England that included some famous writers, and then it spread to groups in America and other parts of England besides, I think, London, Oxford was where the original ones were. And there's even some Sherlockian groups in Japan now.
Well, that's interesting. You said that was the original fandom. So are modern-day Star Trek fans and other Star Wars, for that matter, Sherlock Holmes fans kind of paved the way there.
Yes, exactly. In the way that they turned being a fan of Sherlock Holmes into a community, a social group. It's not just a shared taste, but it's actually the foundation for real relationships and a group identity. And the way that they used the stories as a springboard for their own storytelling.
We've got a post here from Libby on Facebook who says, my appreciation of Holmes and Watson grew out of Data and Geordi's repeated holodeck portrayals of them on Star Trek The Next Generation. Just another example of where they've gone, where no one has gone before. Sherlock Holmes has.
Yeah. It's not surprising that that the relationship, the connection between Sherlock Holmes and Star Trek goes back to the original Star Trek, where although the dominance and their relationship is reversed, many people have observed the similarities between Mr. Spock and Sherlock Holmes. Being part of the kind of attraction of the character is that his emotions are supposed to be either non-existent or, you know, comprehensively suppressed. And that is, of course, as the creator of the new series noted, you know, just incredibly sort of provocative to some people who want to imagine that they'd be the one to sort of overcome his aloofness.
We'll leave it there for now. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's really been fun.
That's Laura Miller with Salon.com talking about Sherlock Holmes and her recent piece on Sherlock in Harper's Magazine.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. News is coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.